made up this bad story about Ben, and part of it became true. But your family got a big settlement from the school. It wasn't that big. She eyed the bottom of her glass. But your parents went ahead with it, after you'd told them the truth. My dad was a businessman. He thought we could get some sort of compensation.
But your dad definitely knew, that day, that Ben had not molested you.
Yeah, he did, she said, giving that chickeny neck jerk toward me, defensive.
Buck came and rubbed against her pant leg, and she seemed calm, ran her long fingernails through his fur.
We moved that year. My dad said the place was tainted, but the money didn't really help. I remember he bought me a dog, but every time I tried to talk about the dog, he sort of held his hand up, like it was too much. My mom, she just never forgave me. I'd come home and tell her about something that happened at school, and she'd just say,
"Really?"
Like I was lying, no matter what I said.
I could have told her I ate mashed potatoes for lunch, and she'd just go, "Really?"
And then she'd just stop talking. She'd look at me when I came in the door from school, and then she'd walk over to the kitchen and open a bottle of wine. And she'd just keep refilling, wandering around the house, not talking, always shaking her head. I remember one time I told her I wish I hadn't made her so sad. And she said,
"Well, you did."
Chrissy was crying now, petting the cat rhythmically. And that was it. By the end of the year, my mom was gone. I came home from school one day, and her room was cleared out.
She let her head drop to her lap then, a childish, dramatic gesture, her hair flung over her head. I knew I was supposed to pet her, soothe her, but instead I just waited. And eventually, she peered up at me.
"No one ever forgives me for anything," she whimpered, her chin shaking.
I wanted to tell her I did, but I didn't. Instead, I poured her another drink.
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 6:11 p.m. Patty was still muttering sorries as Lou Cates hustled her toward the door. And suddenly, she was out on the step, in the freezing air, her eyes blinking rapidly. Between blinks, before she could get her mouth to move, to form any sort of word, the door opened again, and out stepped a man in his 50s. He shut the door behind him, and then there they all were on the small front porch. Patty, Diane, Libby, and the man. Basset hound bags beneath watery eyes, his graying hair brushed straight back. He ran a hand through the pomade while he assessed Patty, his Irish clatter ring flashing.
"Mrs. Patty Day?"
His coffee breath lingered in the cold air, vaguely discolored.
"I'm Patty Day, Ben Day's mother.
We came by to find out what's going on with these stories," Diane interrupted. "We've been hearing a lot of rumors, and no one's bothered to talk to us directly." The man cocked his hands on his hips, looked down at Libby, looked quickly away.
"I'm Detective Jim Collins. I'm in charge of this investigation. I had to come by here today to talk to these folks, and then, of course, I was going to get in touch with you. You saved me a drive. You want to talk somewhere else? It's a little cold here."
They went to a Dunkin' Donuts just off the highway, separate cars, Diane muttering a joke about cops and donuts, then cursing Mrs. Cates.
"Wouldn't even give us the time of damn day. Bitch."
Normally, Patty would have said something in Mrs. Cates's defense. Diane's and Patty's roles, straight talker and apologist, were grooved deep. But the Cates family was in no need of defense. Detective Collins was waiting for them with three paper cups of coffee and a carton of milk for Libby.
Didn't know if you'd want her to have sweets, he said.
And Patty wondered if he'd think she was a bad mother if she bought Libby a donut, especially if he knew they'd had pancakes that morning. This will be my life from now on, she thought, always having to think about what people will think.
Libby was smearing her face against the pastry glass already, though, hopping from one foot to another, and so Patty fished around in her pocket for some change and got a pink frosted donut, gave it to Libby on a napkin. She could not deal with Libby feeling denied, staring mournfully at those pastel shades of sugar while they tried to have a conversation about whether her son was a devil-worshipping child molester. Again, she almost laughed. She settled Libby at a table behind them and told her to sit still and eat while the grown-ups talked.
You all redheads?
Colin said.
Where's the red come from? You Irish?
Patty thought immediately of her always conversation with Len about their red hair. And then she thought, the farm's going away. How did I forget that the farm's going away? German, she said for the second time that day.
You have another few little ones, don't you?
Colin said. Yes, I have 4 children.
Same daddy?
Diane rustled in the seat next to her.
Of course, same daddy. But you are a single mother, correct?
Collins asked. We're divorced, yes, Patty said, trying to sound as prim as a church wife.
What's this got to do with what's happening to Ben? Diane snapped, leaning across the table. I'm Patty's sister, by the way. I take care of these kids almost as much as she does.
Patty winced. Detective Collins watched her wince.
Let's try to start this civilly, Collins said, because we've got a long way to go together before this is cleared up. The charges leveled against your son, Mrs. Day, are of a very serious and very concerning nature. At this point, we've got 4 little girls who say that Ben touched them in their private areas, that he made them touch him, that he took them out to some farm area and performed certain acts that are associated with ritualistic devil worship.
He said those words, ritualistic devil worship, the way people who don't know cars repeat what the mechanic said. It's a broken fuel pump.
Ben doesn't even have a car, Patty said in a barely audible voice.
Now, the age difference between an 11-year-old and a 15-year-old is only 4 years, but those are very crucial years, continued Collins. We would consider him a danger and a predator if these accusations turn out to be true. And frankly, we'll need to talk not only to Ben, but to your little girls, too.
Ben is a good boy,
Patty said, and hated how limp and weak her voice was.
Everyone likes him.
How is he regarded at school?
Collins asked.
Pardon?
Is he considered a popular kid?
He has a lot of friends, Patty mumbled.
I don't think he does, ma'am,
Collins said.
From what we understand, he doesn't have very many friends. He's a bit of a loner. So what does that prove?
Diane snapped.
It proves absolutely nothing, Miss...
Krause.
It proves absolutely nothing, Miss Krause. But that fact, combined with the fact that he doesn't have a strong father figure around, would lead me to believe he may be more vulnerable to, say, a negative influence. Drugs. Alcohol. People who are maybe a bit rougher. A bit troubled.
He doesn't associate with delinquents. If that's what you're worried about, Patty said.
Name some of his friends for me, then,
Collins said.
Name the kids he hangs out with. Name who he was with last weekend.
Patty sat, tongue thick in her mouth, and then shook her head, folded her hands near a smear of someone else's chocolate icing. It was late coming, but now, finally, she was being revealed for what she was—
a woman who couldn't quite keep it together, who lived from emergency to emergency, borrowing money, scrambling for sleep, sliding by when she should have been tending to Ben, encouraging him to pick up a hobby or join a club, not secretly grateful when he locked himself in his room or disappeared for an evening, knowing it was one less kid to deal with.
There are some parenting gaps, then.
Colin sighed, like he already knew the end to the story. We want a lawyer before anything else happens, before you talk to any of the kids. Diane interrupted. Frankly, Mrs. Day, Colin said, not even glancing at Diane.
With three little girls at home, if I were you, I'd want the truth out more than anyone. This kind of behavior doesn't go away. In fact, if this is true, and to be frank, I think it is, your daughters were probably his first victims.
Patty looked behind at Libby, who sat licking the frosting off her donut. She thought of how much Libby used to hang on Ben. She thought of all the chores the kids did on their own. Sometimes, after a day working in the barn with Ben, the girls would come back to the house, irritated, weepy. But what? They were little girls. They got tired out and cranky. She wanted to throw her coffee in Collins's face.
May I speak plainly? Colin said, his voice kneading her. I can't imagine how horrible it must be to hear these things as a mother. But I can tell you something, and this is straight from our psychologist who's been working one-on-one with these girls, and I can tell you what he tells me. That's that these girls, they're telling us things a fifth grader wouldn't know about sexually unless they'd actually happened. He says they are classic abuse scenarios. You know about the McMartin case, of course.
Patty vaguely remembered. A preschool in California, and all the teachers were on trial for being devil worshippers, molesting the kids. She could remember the evening newscast, a pretty sunny California house, and then black words stamped across it. Daycare nightmare.
Satanic worship is not uncommon, I'm afraid,
Collins was saying.
It's made its way into all areas of the community, and devil worshippers tend to target young men, get them in the fold. And part of devil worship is the degradation of children.
Do you have any evidence? Diane bellowed at Collins. Any witnesses besides some 11-year-old girls? Do you even have kids yourself? Do you know how easily they imagine things? Their whole lives are make-believe. So do you have anyone to vouch for these lies but a bunch of little girls and some Harvard know-it-all psychiatrist who impresses you all?
Well, as far as evidence, the girls all said he took their underpants as some sick souvenir or something,
Colin said to Patty.
If you'd let us look around your home, we could start to clear that up.
We need to talk to a lawyer before that, Diane grumbled to Patty. Colin swallowed his coffee and stifled a belch, banged his chest with a fist, and smiled mournfully over Patty's shoulder at Libby. He had the red nose of a drinker.
Right now, we just need to be calm. We will talk to everyone involved,
Colin said, still ignoring Diane.
We interviewed several faculty members from his high school and the grade school this afternoon, and what we hear doesn't make us feel any better, Mrs. Day. A teacher? Mrs. Darksilver?
He looked at Patty for her to confirm the name, and Patty nodded. Mrs. Darksilver had always loved Ben. He'd been an especial favorite of hers.
Just this morning she saw your son nosing around Chrissy Cates's locker, in the grade school, during Christmas break. This disturbs me. And
he looked at Patty from the bottom of his eyes, aiming the pink rims at her.
Mrs. Darksilver says he was apparently aroused.
What does that mean? Snapped Diane.
He had an erection.
When we looked inside Chrissy's van,
we found a note of a provocative nature. Mrs. Day, in our interviews, your son was repeatedly characterized as an outcast, a misfit, odd. He's considered a bit of a time bomb. Some of the teachers are actually frightened of him.
Frightened? Patty repeated. How can they be frightened of a 15-year-old boy?
You don't know what we found in his locker.
What they found in his locker. Patty thought Collins would say drugs or girly magazines. Or in a merciful world, a bunch of outlaw firecrackers. That's what she wanted Ben to be in trouble for. A dozen Roman candles sitting like kindling in his backpack. That she could take. Even when Collins did his greasy lead-up. This is very disturbing, Mrs. Day. I want you to prepare yourself. Patty had figured, maybe a gun. Ben loved guns. Always had. It was like his airplane phase and his cement truck phase, except this one just kept going. It was something they did together. Had done together. Hunting. Shooting. Maybe he brought one to school just to show it off. The Colt Peacemaker. His favorite. He was not supposed to go into the cabinet without her permission, but if he had, they'd deal with it. So let it be a gun. Collins had cleared his throat then, and said, in a voice that made them lean in,
"We found some remains in your son's locker. Organs. At first we thought they might be part of a baby, but it seems they're animal. Female reproductive parts in a plastic container from maybe a dog or a cat. You missing a dog or a cat?"
Patty was still woozy from the revelation they actually thought Ben might have part of a baby in his locker. That they thought he was so disturbed that infanticide was actually their first guess. It was right then, staring down at a scattering of pastel donut sprinkles, that she decided her son was going to prison. If that's how twisted they believed her son to be, he had no chance.
"No, we're not missing any pets."
"Our family is hunters, farmers," Diane said. "We're around animals, dressing animals all the time. It's not so strange that he might have something from them." "Really? Do you keep parts of dead animals in your home?"
For the first time, Collins looked straight at Diane, a hard stare he cut off after just a few seconds.
"Is there a law against it?"
Diane barked back.
"One of the rituals that devil worshippers engage in is the sacrifice of animals, Mrs. Day," Collins said. "I'm sure you heard about them cattle axed up over near Lawrence. We think that and the involvement with the little girls all ties together."
Patty's face was cold. "It was done. It was all done." "What do you want me to do?" she asked.
"I'll follow you to your place so we can talk to your son. Okay?"
Collins said, turning paternal on that last note, his voice going high, almost flitting into baby talk. Patty could feel Diane's hands clenched next to her.
"He's not at home. We've been trying to find him."
"We absolutely need to talk to your son, Mrs. Day. Where do you think we can find him?"
"We don't know where he is," Diane interrupted. "We're in the same boat as you."
"Are you going to arrest him?"
Patty asked.
"We can't do anything until we talk to him. And the sooner we do, the sooner we'll get this cleared up."
"That's not an answer," Diane said.
"Only one I got, ma'am."
"That means yes," Diane said. And for the first time, she lowered her eyes. Collins stood up and walked over toward Libby during the last exchange. Now he was kneeling down next to her, giving her a,
"Hi, sweetie."
Diane grabbed his arm. "No, leave her alone." Collins frowned down on her.
"I'm just trying to help." Don't you want to know if Libby is okay?
We know Libby is okay.
Why don't you let her tell me that? Or we could have child services.
Screw off,
Diane said, getting in front of him. Patty sat in her place, willing herself to disconnect. She heard Diane and Colin snapping behind her, but she just sat and watched the woman behind the counter make another pot of coffee, trying to focus all her interest on the coffee. It worked for just a second before Diane was pulling Patty and Libby, her mouth grimy with donut, out of the restaurant. Patty felt like crying some more on the way home, but wanted to wait until Diane was gone. Diane made Patty drive, said it would be good for her to focus. The whole way home, Diane had to tell her which gears to switch to, she was so distracted.
Why don't you try third, P? I think we need to go down to two now.
Libby sat in the back seat, saying nothing, bundling herself up, knees to chin.
Is something bad going to happen? Libby finally asked.
No, honey.
It seems like something bad's going to happen.
Patty had another panic flash then. What the hell was wrong with her? Taking a 7-year-old into this kind of situation. Her mother would not have done this. Then again, her mother wouldn't have raised Ben the way Patty had, slipshod and fingers crossed, so it wouldn't have been an issue. Right now, she had an almost obsessive need to get home, nest up, feel safe. The plan was Patty would wait for Ben to get back. He had to be back soon now. And Diane would go out and assess the gossip. Who knew what, whose side people were taking, and who in God's name Ben was hanging around with. They rattled up to the house and saw Patty's Cavalier and another car. Some bucket-seated sports car that looked about 10 years old, spattered with mud.
Who's that? Diane asked.
No idea. She said it tragically. Already, Patty knew whoever it was, it would be depressing news. They opened the front door and felt the heat roll out. The thermostat had to be past 80. The first thing they saw was an open box of microwave cocoa, the kind with fake marshmallows, on the dining room table, a trail of the cocoa mix leading to the kitchen. Then Patty heard that wheezy laugh and knew. Runner was sitting on the floor, sipping hot chocolate with her daughters leaning on him. Some nature show was on the TV, the girl squealing and grabbing his arms as an alligator boomed out of the water and snapped something with horns. He looked up lazily, as if she were a delivery person.
Hiya, Patty. Long time no see ya.
We got some family stuff going on, Diane injected.
You should go on home.
During those stretchy weeks that Runner had returned to stay with them, he and Diane had scraped several times, her bellowing and him blowing her off.
You're not the husband, Diane.
He'd go to the garage, get drunk, throw an old baseball against the wall for hours. Diane was not going to be the one to get Runner to go home. It's okay, Dee. You go on. Call me in an hour or so. Let me know what's going on, okay? Diane glared at Runner, grumbled something into her chest and stalked out, the door shutting firmly behind her. Michelle said,
"Geez, what's with her?"
and made a funny face for her dad, the little traitor. Her brown hair was wild from static where Runner had done his Indian rub. Runner had always been weird with the kids, roughly affectionate, but not in a grown-up way. He liked to pinch and flick them to get their attention. They'd be watching TV, and he'd suddenly lean across and get a good snap on their skin. Whichever of the girls he'd just stung would look over at him in a teary, outraged pout, and he'd laugh and go,
"What?"
Or,
"I was just saying hi. Hi."
And when he went with them anywhere, he trailed a few steps behind instead of walking beside them. Eyes sideways on them. It always reminded her of an old coyote trotting at the heels of its prey, just teasing for a few miles before it attacked.
"Daddy made us macaroni," Debbie said. "He's going to stay for dinner."
"You know you aren't supposed to let anyone in the house while I'm away," Patty said, wiping up the powder with a rag that already smelled. Michelle rolled her eyes, leaned into Runner's shoulder.
"Geez, Mom, it's Dad."
It would have been easier if Runner was just dead. He had so little interaction with his children, was of so little help to them that if he'd pass on, things would only improve. As it was, he lived on in the vast out there somewhere, occasionally swooping in with ideas and schemes and orders that the kids tended to follow, because Dad said so. She'd love to tell Runner off right now. Tell him about his son and the disturbing collection in his locker. The idea of Ben cutting and holding on to animal parts made her throat close. The Kate's girl and her friends, that was a misunderstanding that may or may not end well. The assortment of body parts she couldn't think of an excuse for, and she was good at thinking up excuses. She didn't worry about what Collins said, that Ben may have molested his sisters. She had examined that thought on the ride home, turned it over, peered in its mouth and inspected its teeth, been excruciatingly thorough, and there was not a doubt in her. Ben would never do that. But she knew her son did have a taste for hurt. There was that moment with the mice, that robotic shovel pounding, his mouth pulled away from his teeth, his face trickling sweat. He'd gotten some pleasure from that, she knew. He roughhoused with his sisters hard. Sometimes giggles turned into screams, and she'd come round the corner and see him holding Michelle's arm behind her back, just slowly, slowly pulling up. Or grabbing hold of Debbie's arm, vice-like, for an Indian rub, and what starts as a joke gets more and more frantic, him rubbing until he draws speckles of blood, his teeth grinding. She could see him getting that same look Runner got when he was around the kids, jacked up and tense. "Dad needs to leave."
"Geez, Patty, not even a hi before you toss me out? Come on, let's talk. I got a business proposition for you."
"I'm in no position to make a business deal, Runner," she said. "I'm broke."
"You're never as broke as you say," he said with a leer, and twisted his baseball cap backward on stringy hair.
He'd meant it to sound jokey, but it came out menacing, as if she'd better not be broke if she knew what was good for her. He dumped the girls off him and walked over to her, standing too close as always, beer sweat sticking his long john shirt to his chest.
"Didn't you just sell the tiller, Patty? Vern Evely told me you just sold the tiller."
"And all that money's gone, Runner. It's always gone as quick as I get it." She tried to pretend to sort through mail. He stayed right on top of her.
"I need you to help me. I just need enough cash to get to Texas."
Of course, Runner would want to go where it was warm for the winter, traveling child-free like a gypsy from season to season as he did, an insult to her and her farm and her attachment to this single place on the ground. He picked up work and spent the money on stupid things, golf clubs because he pictured himself golfing someday, a stereo system he'd never hook up. Now he was planning to hightail it to Texas. She and Diane had driven to the Gulf when Patty was in high school, the only time Patty'd been anywhere. It was the saltiness in the air that stuck with her, the way you could suck on a strand of hair and make your mouth start watering. Somehow Runner would find some cash, and he'd spend the rest of winter in some honky-tonk alongside the ocean, sipping a beer while his son went to jail. She couldn't afford a lawyer for Ben. She kept thinking that. "Well, I can't help you, Runner. I'm sorry." She tried to aim him toward the door, and instead he pushed her farther into the kitchen, his stale sweet breath making her turn her head away. "Come on, Patty.
Why do you have to make me beg? I'm in a real jam here. It's life or death stuff. I got to get the hell out of Dodge. You know I wouldn't be asking otherwise. Like, I might be killed tonight if I can't scrape up some money. Just give me $800. The figure actually made her laugh. Did the guy really think that was her pocket change? Could he not look around and see how poor they were? The kids in shirt sleeves in the middle of winter? The kitchen freezer stacked with piles of cheap meat, each one marked with a long-gone year? That's what they were, a home past the expiration date. I don't have anything, Runner. He looked at her with fixed eyes, his arm leaning across the doorway so she couldn't leave. You got jewelry, right? You got the ring I gave you? Runner, please. Ben's in trouble. Bad trouble. I got a lot of bad stuff going on right now. Just come back another time, okay? What the hell has Ben done? There's been some trouble at school. Some trouble in town. It's bad. I think he might need a lawyer, so I need any money I have for him, and... So you do have money? Runner, I don't. Give me the ring, at least. I don't have it.
The girls were pretending to watch TV, but their rising voices made Michelle, nosy Michelle, turn her head and openly stare at them.
Give me the ring, Patty. He held out his hand like she might actually be wearing it. That chintzy fake gold engagement ring that she knew was embarrassing, flimsy, even at 17. He'd given it to her 3 months after he proposed. It took him 3 months to get off his ass, go down to a 5 and dime and buy the little bit of tinsel he gave her while on his third beer. I love you forever, baby, he'd said. She knew immediately then that he'd leave, that he was not a man to depend on, that he was not even a man she liked very much. And still, she'd gotten pregnant 3 more times because he didn't like to wear condoms and it was too much trouble to nag. Runner, do you not remember that ring? That ring is not going to get you any money. It cost about $10. Now you're going to be a bitch about the ring? Now.
Believe me, if it had been worth anything, I'd have pawned it already.
They stood facing each other, Runner breathing like an angry donkey, his hands shaking. He put them on her arms, then removed them with exaggerated effort. Even his mustache was shaking.
You are really going to be sorry about this, Patty.
I already am, Runner. Been sorry a long time.
He turned, and his jacket brushed a cocoa packet onto the floor, scattering more brown powder at his feet.
Bye, girls. Your mom's a bitch!
He kicked one of the tall kitchen chairs over, and it cartwheeled into the living room. They all froze like forest creatures as Runner paced in tight circles, Patty wondering if she should make a run for a rifle or grab a kitchen knife. All the while, mind pleading that he just leave.
Thanks for fucking nothing!
He tramped to the front door, swung the door open so hard it cracked the wall behind it, and bounced back.
He kicked it open again, grabbed it, banged it into the wall, his head bowed low against it, all his strength slamming it again and again.
Then he left, his car screeching down away from the house. And Patty fetched the shotgun, loaded it, and set it atop the mantelpiece with a scattering of shells, just in case.
Libby Day, now. Chrissy ended up sleeping on my couch. I'd walked her to the door and realized she wasn't okay to drive. She was slip-slopping in her shoes, a web of mascara down one cheek. As she swayed out onto my porch, she turned around suddenly and asked about her mother, if I knew where her mother was or how to find her. And it was then that I pulled Chrissy back inside, made her a Velveeta sandwich, parked her on the sofa, and wrapped a blanket over her. As she rolled into sleep, setting the last quarter of the sandwich carefully on the floor beside her, 3 of my lotion bottles fell out of her jacket. Once she passed out, I tucked them back in. She was gone when I woke up, the blanket folded with a note scrawled on the back of an envelope. Thanks. Sorry. So Lou Cates didn't kill my family, if Chrissy was to be believed. I believed her. On that count, at least. I decided to drive down to see Runner, ignore the 2 messages from Lyle and the 0 messages from Diane. Drive down to see Runner. Get some answers. I didn't think he had anything to do with the murders, whatever his girlfriend might say. But I wondered if he knew something, with his debts and his drinking and his gutter friends. If he knew something or heard something, or if maybe his debts had triggered some horrible vengeance. Maybe I could believe in Ben again, which is what I wanted to do. I knew now why I'd never gone to visit him. It was too tempting, too easy to ignore the prison walls and just see my brother, hear the Ben-specific cadence of his voice, that downward slope at the end of every sentence, like it might be the last thing he was ever going to say. Just seeing him, I remembered things, nice things, or not even nice, just regular things. I could get a whiff of home, way back when everyone was alive. Man, I wanted that. I stopped at the 7-Eleven on the way out of town, bought a map and some cheese-flavored crackers that I discovered were diet when I bit into them. I ate them anyway, heading south, the orange powder floating through the car. I should have stopped for a meal on the way to Oklahoma. The air on the highway was thick with tempting smell pockets, French fries, fast food fish, fried chicken. But I was in an unnatural panic. Worried for no good reason I would miss Runner if I stopped, and so I ate the diet crackers and a mealy apple I'd found on the corner of my kitchen counter. Why was the note, that dirty note that wasn't addressed to Ben, mixed up in a box of Michelle's stuff? If Michelle had found out Ben had a girlfriend, she'd have lorded it over him, all the more if he tried to keep it a secret. Ben hated Michelle. Ben had tolerated me, had dismissed Debbie, but he'd hated Michelle actively. I remembered him pulling her out of his room by an arm, her whole body almost sideways, Michelle up on tiptoes, moving with him to keep from being dragged. He tossed her out, and she fell against the wall, and he told her if she ever came in his room again, he'd kill her. His teeth flared whenever he talked to her. He screamed at her for always being underfoot. She'd hover outside his door day and night, listening. Michelle always knew everyone's secrets. She never had a conversation that didn't have an angle. I remembered that more vividly since discovering her bizarre notes. If you don't have money, gossip isn't bad leverage, even inside one's own family. Ben talks to himself a lot, Michelle announced at breakfast one morning, and Ben reached across the table, knocking her plate into her lap and grabbed her by the shirt collar. Leave me the fuck alone! He screamed. And then my mom calmed him down, got him back to his room, lectured us, as always. Later, we found bits of egg that had catapulted up onto the plastic chandelier over the table, the chandelier that looked like it came from a pizza parlor. So what did that mean? Ben wouldn't kill his family because his little sister found out he had a girlfriend. I passed a field of cows, standing immobile, and thought about growing up. All the rumors of cattle mutilation and people swearing it was devil worshippers. The devil lurked nearby in Arkansas town, an evil that was as natural and physical as a hillside. Our church hadn't been too brimstony, but the preacher had certainly nurtured the idea. The devil, goat-eyed and bloody, could take over your heart just as easily as Jesus if you weren't careful. In every town I lived in, there were always the devil kids and the devil houses, just like there was always a killer clown driving around in a white van. Everyone knew of some old, vacant warehouse on the edge of town where a stained mattress sat on the floor, bloody from sacrifice. Everyone had a friend of a cousin who had actually seen a sacrifice but was too scared to give details. I was 10 minutes into Oklahoma, a good 3 hours to go, and I started smelling something overpoweringly sweet, but rotten. It stung my eyes, made them water. I had a ridiculous quiver of fear that my devil think had summoned the beast.
Then, in the distance, the churning sky turned the color of a bruise. I saw it. Paper plant. I turned the radio on scan. Station 1, Station 2, Station 3. Blasts of unpleasant noise, static, and ads for cars and more static. So I flipped it right back off. Just past a sign with a picture of a cowboy. Welcome to Lidgerwood, Oklahoma, partner. I pulled off the ramp and headed into the town, which turned out to be a busted-down tourist trap of a city. It had once fashioned itself as an Old West locale. The main street was all frosted glass and faux saloons and shops. One storefront called itself the Old Photo Stop, a place where families could commission sepia photos of themselves in frontier garb. In the window hung a poster-sized print, a father holding a lasso, trying to look menacing under a hat too big for him, the little girl in a calico dress and bonnet, too young to get the joke, the mother, dressed as a whore, giving an uncomfortable smile, her arms crossed in front of her thighs where her petticoat was slit. Next to the photo hung a for sale sign. Another matching sign next door at Daphne's Daffy Taffy. More for sales at Buffalo Bill's Amazing Arcade and a storefront with the ridiculous stretch of a name, Wyatt Earp's Slurpees. The whole place seemed dusty. Even the defunct waterslide loop-de-looping in the distance was plugged with dirt. Bert Nolan's group home for men was just 3 blocks off the downtown drag, a square, low building with a tiny front yard infested with foxtail weeds. I'd always liked foxtail as a kid. It appealed to my literal brain because it looked like it sounded. A long, thin stem with a length of fuzz at the top, just like a fox's tail, but green. They grew all over our farm. Entire meadows were given over to the stuff. Michelle and Debbie and I would break off the tops and tickle each other under our wrists. My mom taught us the colloquial names for everything. Lamb's ear, coxcomb, all those plants that lived up to their titles. A lamb's ear is as soft as a lamb's ear. Coxcomb actually looks like a rooster's red comb. I got out of the car and fluttered my hands across the tops of the foxtail. Maybe I'd grow a garden of weeds. Windmill grass actually fans out at the top, like windmill blades. Queen Anne's lace is white and frilly. Witchgrass would be appropriate for me. Some devil's claw. The door to Bert Nolan's group home was made of metal, painted dark gray, like a submarine. It reminded me of the doors in Ben's prison. I rang the bell and waited. Across the street, 2 teenage boys rode their bikes in lazy, wide circles, interested. I rang the bell again and gave the metal a bang that failed to reverberate inside. I debated asking the guys across the way if anyone was home, just to break the silence. As they were looping closer to me, "What you doing there, lady?" The door opened onto a pixie-sized man in bright white sneakers, iron jeans, a western shirt. He jiggled the toothpick in his mouth, not looking at me, flipping through a copy of Cat Fancy magazine.
"Don't open for the night till..."
He trailed off when he saw me.
"Oh, sorry, honey. We're a men's hostel. You have to be a man, and over 18.
"I'm looking for my dad," I said, leaning into my drawl. "Runner Day. Are you the manager?"
"Ha, manager, accountant, priest, cleaning boy," he said, opening the door. "Recovering alcoholic, recovering gambler, recovering deadbeat. Bert Nolan, this is my place. Come in, sweetheart, and remind me of your name."
He opened the door onto a room full of cots, the strong odor of bleach rising up from the floor. The elfin Bert led me through the rows of thin beds, each one still indented from the night, to an office just his size, just my size, which held 1 small desk, a file cabinet, and 2 fold-out chairs we sat down on. The fluorescent light was not flattering to his face, which was pocked with dark, dimpled pores.
"I'm not a weirdo, by the way,"
he said, flapping the cat fancy at me.
"I just got a cat, never had one before. Don't really like her much so far. She was supposed to be good for morale, but so far she just pisses in the beds."
"I have a cat," I volunteered.
surprising myself with my sudden, intense fondness for Buck. If they go outside their litter box, it's usually because they're angry.
That right?
Yeah. Otherwise, they're pretty easy pets.
Huh, Bert Nolan said. Huh. So you're looking for your daddy? Yeah, I remember we spoke. Day. He's like most men here. Should be happy someone's looking for them, after the crap they've pulled at home. Usually money stuff, or lack of money stuff. No money, too much booze. Does not bring out the best. Runner. Huh.
He wrote me a letter, said he was back here.
Will you want to take him home? Take care of him? Bert said.
His eyes were black and shiny, like he'd told himself a joke. Well, I'm not sure about that. I just want to check in.
Ha, good. That was a trick question. People who say they want to find one of my men and take care of them never do.
Nolan smelled his fingertips.
I don't smoke anymore, but sometimes my damn fingers still smell like tobacco.
Is he here?
He's not. He's gone again. I don't allow drinkers here. He just had his third strike.
He say where he went?
Ah, sweetheart. I just don't give out addresses. Just don't. Found that was the smartest way to handle all inquiries. But I'll tell you what, because you seem like a nice lady.
Bert! Came a howl from outside the building.
Ah, ignore that. Just one of my men trying to get in early. That's another thing you learn to never do. Never let anyone in early, ever. And never let anyone in late.
He had lost his train of thought. He stared at me, expectantly. So you said you'd tell me what? I prompted.
What?
How you might help me find my dad?
All right. You can leave a letter here with me.
Mr. Nolan, I've already done that. That's why I'm here. I really, really need to find him. I caught myself in the runner stance, palms on the edge of the table, ready to vault myself up if I got mad. Nolan picked up a plaster figurine of an old, balding man throwing his arms out in some expression of exasperation, but I couldn't read the words on the base. Bert seemed to find some consolation in the thing. He let out a sharp sigh between barely parted lips.
Well, sweetheart, I'll tell you what. He may not be here, but I know he's still in Lidgerwood. One of my men saw him just last night outside of Cooney's. He's laying low somewhere, but he's around. Just prepare yourself for some disappointment.
Disappointment about what?
Oh, you name it.
When Bert Nolan got up to lead me out of his office, he turned his back to me, and I immediately made a grab for his little figurine. But I made myself set it back down and took his bag of corn nuts and a pencil instead. Progress. They sat in the car seat next to me as I drove to the nearest bar, Cooney's. Cooney's had not given in to the Old West theme. Cooney's was proudly crappy in the present day. Three wrinkled faces glared at me as I opened the door. This included the bartender. I ordered a beer, the man snapping that he'd need to see my driver's license, holding it up to the light and then down near his belly, giving a humph when he couldn't prove it was fake. I sipped and sat, letting them get used to me being there. Then I spoke. As soon as I hit the word runner, the place lit up.
That jackass stole three cases of beer from me, the bartender said. Went around back in broad daylight and just took him off the truck, and I'd stood him for a lot of drinks, believe me.
The middle-aged man, two stools down, grabbed my arm too hard and said,
Your goddamn daddy owes me $200, and I want my lawnmower back. You tell him I'm looking for him. I know where you can find him, said an old guy with a Hemingway beard and the build of a girl.
Where?
Everyone else said at once.
Bet anything he's living with the rest of them squatters, camped out over at the Superfund site. You should see it, he added, more to the bartender than me. It's like an old-time Hooverville, bonfires and shanties.
Why the hell would anyone live at the Superfund site? The bartender snapped.
Well, you know no one from the government'll show up.
They all laughed angrily. "Is it even safe to go there?" I asked. I pictured toxic waste barrels and lime green sludge.
"Sure, if you don't drink the well water and you're not a grasshopper."
I raised my eyebrows.
"That's what it's from. The whole site is soaked with arsenic. It's an old dumping spot for grasshopper bait. And shitheads," said the bartender.
Ben Day, January 2, 1985, 8:38 p.m. They drove toward town, snow starting to fall. Ben just remembering he left his bike back at the warehouse, and now that was probably gone. "Hey," he yelled up front. Trey and Deandra were talking, but he couldn't hear them over the music screeching on the radio, like ripped sheets of metal.
"Weir, weir, weir, weir.
Could we stop by the compound real quick so I can grab my bike?"
Trey and Deandra exchanged looks.
"No,"
Deandra busted out a grin, and they started laughing. Ben sat back for a second, then leaned back up.
"I'm serious. I need it."
"Forget it, dude. It's gone," Trey said. "You can't leave shit at the compound."
They drove onto Bullhart Avenue, the main strip in town, where nothing was happening, as usual. The hamburger joint was a bright yellow diorama featuring a few jocks and their dates, all draped over each other. The stores were black, and even the bar looked barely open. Only a vague light could be seen in the single rectangle of window in the front. The door itself had been painted navy and revealed nothing. They parked right out front, Deandra still finishing her beer, Trey grabbing it from her and drinking the rest. "The baby won't mind." On the sidewalk, some old guy, his face a confusion of wrinkles, his nose and mouth looking like they were molded out of a twist of clay, scowled at them once and walked into the bar.
"Let's do it," Trey said,
and started to get out of the truck. And then when he saw Ben hesitate, still sitting in back, his hands on his knees, Trey stuck his head back in the car and smiled that businesslike smile.
"Don't worry, dude, you're with me. I do a lot of drinking in there. And, hey, you're pretty much visiting your dad at the office."
Deandra fingered the edges of her crunchy curls, her version of running her fingers through it, and they both followed Trey inside. Deandra with her lips pouty and her eyes sexy sleepy, the way she looked in most photos, like you woke her up from a dream about you. Next to her, Ben feeling gangly and droopy as usual, literally dragging his feet. The bar was so smoky Ben choked as soon as he entered. Deandra, already with a cigarette lit, slouching next to him as if that made her look older. A nervous guy, his hair in patches like a molting bird, scurried up to Trey immediately, his head lowered, and muttered something in Trey's ear. Trey nodding, sucking his lips in against his teeth, looking concerned and serious. Ben thought maybe the guy was a manager, was kicking them out, because maybe Deandra passed for older with the extra makeup, but Ben didn't. But Trey just patted the guy on the back, saying something like,
"Don't make me chase, man."
And the nervous guy got a big grin and laughed and said,
"No, no, no, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that at all. Not at all."
And Trey just said, "Sunday," and walked past the guy to the bar, ordered 3 beers and a shot of SoCo, which he swallowed straight off. The bartender was another old, gray-haired fat guy. It seemed like a joke, how much all these dudes looked alike, like living was so hard it just erased your features, rubbed out anything distinctive. The bartender gave Ben and Deandra a wise guy look, a just-so-you-know-I-know look, but slid them 2 beers anyway. Ben turned away from the bar to drink his, 1 foot against a stool, in a way that felt casual, like he'd done it before, because he could feel Trey's eyes on him, looking for something to make fun of.
"I see him. I see Runner," Deandra said.
And before Ben could ask her why she sounded so easy saying his name, Trey was calling it out.
"Hey, Runner, come here."
And Runner got the same nervous weasel look the first guy had. He came loping over, that seesaw walk of his hands jammed in his pockets, his eyes big and yellow.
I just don't have it, man. I just don't. Tried to scrape it up earlier, but I was going to come try to find you. I just got here myself. I can give you the last of my weed in the meantime.
You want to say hi to Deandra? Trey interrupted.
Runner started, then smiled.
Oh, hey, Deandra. Wow, I must be drunk, oblivious.
He pretended to close one eye so he could see better, made a little jump on the tips of his toes.
Heh, yeah, drinking myself cross-eyed because I'm so freaked out about this situation.
Runner, you want to look at who's next to Deandra?
Ben had barely turned to face him. He was trying to think of something to say besides, hey, Dad. But he couldn't, so he just stood there, waiting for the inevitable shittiness to happen. Runner peered through the dimness of the bar and didn't recognize Ben.
Hi there, he said,
and then to Trey.
That your cousin? I can't see too well. Night vision. I need contacts, but...
Oh, my God, Trey said, leaning back to pretend to laugh, but looking enraged. Take another look, asshole.
Ben wasn't sure if he was supposed to display himself better, like some girl hoping to scam. Instead, he stood rigid, staring at his dark flop of hair in an old Schlitz mirror on the far wall, as he watched Runner sidle up to him, reaching a hand out toward him fairy tale-like, as if Runner were a troll and Ben some awful treasure. He kept getting closer, stumbling on Ben's foot, and then they made eye contact, and Runner yelped,
"Oh!"
and seemed even more nervous.
"Hair's not red."
"You remember your son, right? This is your son, isn't it, Runner?"
"It is, my son. Hey, Ben. No one can blame me for that one. Hair's not red. I didn't even know you knew Trey."
Ben shrugged, watching Runner's reflection back away from him in the mirror. He wondered how much Runner owed to Trey, why Ben felt like some ransom victim, not that Runner would actually care if he was up for ransom. He wondered, too, how accidental this visit was. It seemed like spur of the moment, but Ben was guessing now that they were always going to end up here tonight.
"I don't get it, Runner," Trey continued, talking one notch above the country music. "You say you don't have any money. Ben here says you don't have any money, and yet you had that giant stash of weed just a few weeks ago."
"One good weed, though."
He turned his shoulder toward Trey, cutting Ben out of the conversation, shooting backward glances at him, trying to push Trey toward the center of the room by standing closer and closer to him, Trey not moving, finally saying,
"Get off me, man,"
and Runner settling back on his heels.
Nah, man, you're right. It wasn't good stuff, Trey continued. "But you were charging like it was."
"I never charged you nothing, you know?"
"You didn't charge me because you owe me, dipshit. But I know for a fact you were charging $20 for a dime bag. Now where the fuck is the money? You give it to your wife to hold?"
Ex-wife,
Runner yelled.
And then,
"I was trying to get money from her, not give it. I know she's got money there. Even when we were married, she'd hide money, rolls of it, hundreds, from the harvest sales and stick it in funny places. Found $200 in the foot of her pantyhose one time. Maybe I should go back."
He looked over at Ben, who was listening but trying to pretend he was teasing Deandra, his finger twirling Deandra's hair, Deandra only partly playing along.
"Can I talk to you about the situation over there in private?"
Runner pointed over to a corner where three tugboat-sized men were playing pool. The tallest, a pale, white-haired old guy with a marine tattoo, propped his pool cue up and puffed his chest out at them.
"Right," Trey said.
"You can talk in front of me," Ben said, trying to sound like he didn't care.
"Your son needs money from you, just like I do," Trey said. "Maybe worse than I do."
Runner turned from a shriveled position under Trey's black lamp eyes and headed back over to Ben, raising himself to full height. Somewhere since summer, Ben had grown. He was just a little bigger than Runner now, 5'5", 5'6".
"You owe Trey money? Your mom said you was in trouble. You owe Trey?"
He blasted at Ben, his breath yellow, beer and tobacco and maybe a mustardy tuna salad. Ben's stomach grumbled.
No, no.
He was aware his voice sounded nervous, cowed. Deandra shifted her weight next to him.
I don't know any-